Thank you for joining us for the CME Snack, where we will explore some GLP-1 receptor agonist myths and realities, as well as navigating the safety and tolerability of this class of medications. I also want to acknowledge that this program is supported by an independent educational grant from Novo Nordisk. This activity may include discussions of products or devices that are not currently labeled for the use of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA. I would like to start by introducing myself. My name is Mayra Cantasado, and I serve as an assistant professor in the Doctor of Nursing Practice program at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley School of Nursing. I also practice as a nurse practitioner at Valley Diabetes and Endocrinology Comprehensive Center here in Edinburgh, Texas. And for the past 10 years, I've been working in outpatient endocrinology, caring for and providing education to people living with diabetes, which has been one of my greatest passions and one that I feel both grateful and blessed to be able to do so. Today, it's an honor to be here with Dr. Joshua Joseph, who I would like to turn it over so that he can introduce himself.
Thank you so much. My name is Joshua Joseph, and I'm an endocrinologist at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. In addition to seeing patients with diabetes, I also lead a healthy community center where we focus on nutrition and physical activity to improve health. And with that, I'll pass it back to Myra.
I want to start off by bringing our first learning objective, which is to assess the dosing strategies and escalation best practices to optimize patient outcomes and foster therapy adherence. So I'd like to start by discussing some of the most common barriers and gaps that we see in our clinical practice. And one of these challenges that I've seen, personally on the provider side, is that patients often remain on a starter dose for way too long. They've been on this dose for now over for 6 months. And I know this usually comes from a good place. As providers, we want to make sure that we support our patients' tolerability and avoid those potential side effects. But if titration doesn't move forward, those patients never actually reach their therapeutic benefits that we're actually aiming for. So another area of uncertainty comes when patients have to interrupt therapy. Unfortunately, there's a lack of guidance on how to restart, these medications. So it's not always clear. And that often can leave us as providers unsure of the safest or most effective ways to resume. And finally, access. We've all been there where insurance coverage changes. We have medication shortages. Those prior authorization hurdles that we'll talk about a little bit later today. If we don't have a plan B ready, treatment gets delayed, patients get frustrated, and the outcomes suffer. Which is another key challenge that as providers, we often face. But the barriers aren't just on our end, unfortunately. Patients also face some of these challenges. For example, many believe that the starter dose is the full treatment dose, which could set up for those false expectations that our patients can have. Others may skip the doses or when they restart, they do so incorrectly. And to help bring some of these barriers to life, I'd like to start off with a patient case scenario that we're going to come back to throughout today's discussion. So this is EU. She's a 63-year-old woman with type 2 diabetes. She's been on dulaglutide 0.75 milligrams weekly, for the past 10 weeks, and she's doing pretty well. Her medical history includes having type 2 diabetes, peripheral artery disease, and hyperlipidemia. And her most recent hemoglobin A1C is 8.7. Her BMI is 28, and her eGFR is 70. And we're going to revisit EU's case as we move throughout the learning points today. And I want to, take a step back and look at the current FDA indications and dosing schedules for the GLP-1 therapies that we have available. And I think it's very important for us to remember that each of these agents comes with its own titration schedule. And that can be challenging in our practice. As providers, we really need to keep in mind the doses of which these medications were studied and approved for, particularly for those outcomes that go beyond glucose control, like cardiovascular risk reduction. Each therapy, it has its unique characteristics, which makes individualizing treatments both an opportunity and a challenge. And as many of us know, these challenges aren't just clinical, they're practical too. A medication that worked well for a patient last year may suddenly not be longer, may no longer be covered. When that happens, we often need to transition them to another agent. And as we just saw, the dosing schedules aren't interchangeable. And that creates another layer of complexity for both us and our patients. So with that in mind, I'd like to bring, Joshua into this discussion and ask, what practical strategies do you use in your practice to make sure patients are actually reaching those evidence-based doses?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, when you think about small practices, large practices, academic health systems, private health systems, everyone uses different strategies. But I think the key really is effective communication, right? So the patient has to know where they're trying to get in terms of the ultimately, effective dose for them, the most tolerable effective dose for them. And then we have to set up pathways to ensure that they get there. So, for instance, in my practice, we have patients use MyChart, where at the end of the month, or getting towards the end of the month, they send a message. They let us know how they're tolerating the medication. And then we're able to put in that next dose for them, right? But it does require them to send us a message, right? Whereas I have friends and colleagues who have other practices who it's automated on one of the health team members where they get an automated message and they then reach out to the person and say, how are you doing with the medication? And then up titrate to the next dose for the follow-up prescription. And so, I think as long as you have a system that effectively engages with individuals so that you know that they are, doing well on the current dose and it's time to titrate to that next dose, I think that's fine. I have other colleagues who use calendar invites on their own calendar, right? And they just, those pop up in the morning, they send the message, they get a response back. And so whatever system, you feel like is appropriate, go with that, but ensure that your patients are ultimately getting to that highest tolerable dose. What kind of systems do you use, Myra?
I actually hearing you say that, I really love that, how engaged and proactive you are with your patients. I myself sometimes as well, set myself a little reminders to that pop out at certain times, like you mentioned. Sometimes I have, like I send a little telephone encounter for my MAs to make sure that they check in on patient on how he's doing after certain weeks and, serve as that reminder to make sure that they titrate up their dose.
I love that where you mentioned kind of utilizing the MA is one effective strategy that has been shown to work to ensure people get to their optimal dose.
So for the, for the next couple of slides, you'll have available, this will point out the different, the agents that we have of your GLP-1 receptor agonist. On some agents, we have more than FDA approval indications than just for their type 2 diabetes management and for that glucose control. And we also have where to start the dose and then the titration schedule.
I would just say, generally that, you're increasing dosing every 4 weeks in general, but that, it is responsive to the patient, that, some patients may need a little bit longer for some of those, GI challenges to, kind of subside. And so you're really trying to understand where the patient's at. But then once the patient is doing well, to ensure that you're kind of going up to that next dose.
And what's your approach when it has, to have that conversation with your patients when it comes to glucose control, weight loss, or, for now, their newest, indications like MASH, for example?
So that, that's a great question. And, when I think about patients living with diabetes, everyone's individual, right? And everyone also has other conditions, everything from kidney dysfunction or MASH or cardiovascular disease, et cetera. And so when I'm thinking through the medications alongside of them, I kind of go through, okay, this is how much it lowers your A1C. This is how it's going to improve kidney function. This is what it's been showing for liver disease. And then ultimately, another one that patients ultimately want to talk about it often is weight loss, right? And so, what's going to be that weight loss benefit? And then the last thing I talk about with the medications is really the side effects. What is the side effect profile of the different medications? And then together, we can kind of determine, which medication they would prefer. And then in that last part, I talk about, is it covered by their insurance or not? And really look at which ones their insurer is covering. And so we go through which ones, We talk about what their preference would be and then review the insurance recommendations as well.
Thank you for sharing that, Joshua. And you mentioned something, earlier when you talked about, the renal function. And I think, with some of the older agents like exenatide, we had to be very cautious since these medication was renally cleared. Their immediate release version, I remember, when I first started working, you had to check their eGFR. So it wasn't recommended if their GFR fell below 30, or with the extended version, if their eGFR, was less than 45. But now, luckily, as healthcare providers, and now with the use of the human GLP-1 analogs, that we commonly use today, like your dulaglutide, liraglutide, semaglutide, and your tirzepatide, the picture is different here. And these medications are not extensively cleared by the kidneys, which means in general, there's no dose adjustments needed. Some references still suggest being cautious in the end-stage renal disease, but overall, renal function is no longer the barrier it once was. And that's really reassuring because it means more for our patients can stay on these therapies without that unnecessary interruptions. And now that we've covered the dosing and renal consideration, I think it's an important part of prescribing GLP-1 receptor agonist, is the adverse events that you also mentioned earlier, Joshua. And although this table lists, some several potential adverse events, the overall safety profile of these agents has been, very well characterized and generally favorable. But some key points, from this table that I would like to make sure that we discuss. We see that GI side effects are the most common across the class. Nausea, vomiting, diarrhea are by far the most frequent adverse events, with rates generally ranging from 20 to 40%, depending on the agent and the formulation. And this is why patient education and careful titration is so important. Injection site reactions are also, they're uncommon, but they were a bit higher back then with the use of exenatide ER, since that formulation could cause some injection site nodules. Hypoglycemia is very rare unless we combine these agents with insulin or sulfonylurea. When it comes to pancreatitis, gallbladder disease, and thyroid C-cell tumors, which are listed on the label, but these remain overall, rare events. So still, it's important to make sure that we counsel our patients and watch for those symptoms, especially when it comes to that abdominal pain that hasn't, or that doesn't resolve. So when we look across this class, the main challenge here is, really that GI tolerability. The most serious safety issues, are rare, but they're the ones we have to keep in mind for appropriate monitoring and that patient counseling. So when it comes to nausea, as we can see, it's one of the most common, but it's also very manageable. In my clinical practice, I like to tell my patients, if you're feeling a little nausea, it's, the medication doing its job. But what I like to, approach this and talk to them is I go to the rule of three S approach. That comes into play, which is my slow, my small, and my simple. So when it comes to slow, I tell my patients, you want to make sure that you're eating slowly. Pause between your bites. Sip some water and listen to your body. Do not be in a rush to finish your meals. When it comes to small, I tell the patients that it's important for them to keep their portions small. I encourage them to eat smaller meals, smaller portions. I tell them that if they're used to eating your whole burger, for them just to give me just to consume only half of what they were used to eating. And this will also help with, to reduce those nausea or GI discomforts. And lastly, when it comes to the third S, I say it's simple, avoid those greasy, fried, or heavy foods. So Joshua, in your clinical practice, how do you prepare patients for these GI side effects and you like set expectations on how they're more likely to stay on therapy? Do you find any concerns about pancreatitis or thyroid cancer that they often come up in your patients' conversations?
Yeah, Mara, I agree with a lot of what you said there, right? That, one, talking to them about it, give them the numbers of people who experience that. I usually do that out of 10, so 4 out of 10 or 5 out of 10 or
Love that.
6 out of 10, right? When we think about nausea, vomiting, as you mentioned, kind of initiating at the lowest dose, titrating gradually, using small meals, hydration, making sure people are staying hydrated. And then ultimately, some people can benefit from short-term use of some antiemetics for some individuals. When we think about gastroesophageal reflux or GERD, once again, very, very similar, but adding in avoiding late-night eating, right? Because most people get GERD late at night, right? After they go to bed, right? And so really thinking and talking to them about that. You talked about low blood sugars. I talk to people who are on insulin or on a sulfonylurea about this. And for many individuals, we're able to cut down on that insulin over the course of them taking a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And so I talked to them about that. And I also talked to them about treatment techniques for hypoglycemia. And then when we think about pancreatitis, so important to educate them around severe abdominal pain and what to do. Discontinuing medication immediately, seeking treatment, getting an amylase, lipase, imaging, et cetera, if they're having those symptoms of pancreatitis. And then you mentioned gallbladder disease. So really monitoring for those biliary symptoms, counseling to really report the persistent right upper quadrant pain for individuals, and then also consider imaging for those individuals as well. And so I think we're really similar and aligned on this. And I think it's important to go over that a couple of times because we can't place enough importance on mitigating the side effects for individuals.
I agree, and thank you for sharing that, Joshua. Very good inputs and practical pearls to keep in mind as a provider. I think one of another things is as exciting as these GLP-1 therapies are, it's really also important to know when to use them, as it is to when not to use them. To your point, Joshua. So let's talk a little bit more about what makes a good candidate for a GLP-1 receptor agonist and who may not be a good candidate. On the positive side here, when I see this, we know that GLP-1 receptor agonists can be a great option for a broad group of patients. So we know that anyone with type 2 diabetes, regardless of their starting hemoglobin A1C, which I think is a very important aspect that, guidelines have now really emphasized, your American Diabetes Association, your ACE guidelines, that we need to make sure that we are not afraid to incorporate these agents. When you see a patient that has an A1C less than 7, that patient already has comorbidities. We definitely want to be making sure that we're keeping these agents in mind. So, for example, those patients who are obese or overweight, those patients who have the established cardiovascular disease, that risk for MACE, and those with chronic kidney disease. And most recently, patients with the MASH now. And we can't also forget about those patients who also now suffer from the severe obstructive sleep apnea. These are all great groups of patients who would be, key candidates. And on the other hand, there are some important groups where we should avoid or be very cautious with the use of GLP-1 therapy. And these are your patients with a personal or family history of medullary thyroid carcinoma or MEN2 because of the box warning that we know these agents contain. Also, anyone with a prior serious hypersensitivity to a GLP-1, those patients who are pregnant or breastfeeding women, since safety data is still lacking here, are older adults who are underweight or with poor oral intake, where the risk of malnutrition outweighs their benefits. And of course, those with so severe gastroparesis or are expressing that chronic nausea and vomiting where they're not even able to keep anything down, not even water, when these drugs can potentially, worsen those symptoms. So the key message here is that GLP-1 receptor agonists can provide, tremendous benefits, but success depends on selecting the right patient. Careful consideration of the comorbidities and overall medical history is very important for us to consider when it comes to its safe and effective use. So now that we've covered who the right candidates are, the next step is to understanding how to start and escalate, these GLP-1 therapies in practice. So when we start a GLP-1, the rule of thumb is, we've heard this many times, is to start low, go slow, but it's important that we still go. Those starter doses are designed, for tolerability, not for that optimal efficacy that we're wanting. So it's very important that we set those expectations early for our patients. This is why we don't want them to just remain on that starting dose. We want to provide guidance on the common GI side effects and the ways that we want to minimize them, like we just talked about earlier. We want to also reinforce that adherence during the titration is critical. We don't want them to be skipping doses or stopping the dose too soon, because this can make their tolerability even worse. And of course, we want to make sure that we provide that individualized nutrition and activity counseling as well as part of the overall treatment plan. So once initiation is underway, the goal is really for us to advance to the therapeutic maintenance dose. We want to make sure, of course, that we follow the manufacturer's recommended intervals for that dose increase. And if patients are tolerating it well, to continue the progression to that full therapeutic dose. But it's also important for us to remember as providers that, the timing can be individualized. If a patient is struggling with moderate side effects, it's perfectly reasonable to pause at a lower dose, take a little break, remain on that dose for a little longer before escalating further. So overall, initiation and escalation of a GLP-1 is about balancing that tolerability with the progress. And the end goal is always to reach and maintain the effective therapeutic dose. But how do we get there can and should be tailored to each patient. If a patient, for missed has certain missed doses, the approach here depends on how many, were skipped. In many cases, patients can simply resume. But if there's been too much of a lag on the many doses, being missed, we may need to consider, restarting the patient at the, from the start again and reinitiating this titration process to avoid, potential GI side effects. And of course, always, consider those comorbidities, those drug-to-drug interactions and drug-disease interactions when making any adjustment. And when it comes to maintenance dose, the ultimate goal is to have patients on a tolerated therapeutic maintenance dose that provides that sustained benefit. We want to also reinforce the ongoing importance of those lifestyle measures. So let's now circle back to the case where we started with, which our patient, EU. And as we mentioned, she's been on the same GLP-1 dose for quite a while, and that really raises an important clinical question. What are some reasons why a patient might remain at a lower dose for longer than expected? And along with that, how do we decide when and how to approach this dose escalation? So Joshua, how do you handle this in your practice, especially, when you have patients who already feel comfortable where they are?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is where I try to provide the evidence and the education up front. So that when we start people on that lowest dose, I talk about that as a starter dose or a baby dose or a half dose so that your body can get used to it. So that they understand up front that this isn't their final destination, that this we're just taking off of things, right? This is just liftoff, right? We've still got to get to 10,000 feet, right? And so with that, I think people have a much greater understanding that there will be those escalations over time. And then you limit some of these other challenges kind of in the future. So kind of that old adage, about, pounds and ounces, right? And, ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, right? So here, an ounce of education, is worth a lot of time, on the back end.
I love that. I when your whole aspect of education, and I couldn't agree with you more with that. Absolutely. So now let's move to another case. This time, patient LT. LT is a 36-year-old woman with type 2 diabetes. She's currently at her target dose of tirzepatide with high and having good results. Her A1C is 6.8. Her BMI has decreased from 27 to 23, and her kidney function is normal. The challenge here is that her insurance formulary has changed. It no longer covers tirzepatide, but it does cover semaglutide subcutaneous weekly. So here are some important questions that I want to make sure that that we consider. So what are these concerns we need to anticipate in scenarios like this? And how would you approach discussing this issue with LT to help her maintain access to effective therapy? And if we do have to switch, how do we approach transitioning from tirzepatide to semaglutide and adjusting the dose? And I think we've all had patients who are doing very well clinically, but then we run into a barrier with insurance coverage or formulary restrictions. And this is where prior authorizations really, unfortunately, play such a critical part of our work as providers. For me, one of the most important lessons in these situations has been the value of very thorough documentation. I really try to have a very well-documented progress note that clearly outlines all of my patient's prior therapies, especially, making sure that I document any failed treatment attempts. That kind of record not only supports prior authorizations, but also strengthens our case when advocating for them to continue to have access therapy. So when switching my patient to semaglutide, I prefer, and I restart them on the initial dose, on the 0.25 milligram weekly dose for that safety and tolerability. I tell them if they're doing very well, I don't have to take that slow approach, of waiting, for the full 4 weeks before escalating. Sometimes I tell them, in a week or two, if you're doing the 0.25 and you're not feeling like I'm not feeling anything, I don't even see any improvement, then I give them the instructions that, feel comfortable to go up to the 0.5 if that's the case. And then stay on the 0.5 for another 4 weeks. And if you feel good, then we can, gradually titrate your dose as indicated, to help build that, the tolerance. So Joshua, I'd love to hear your perspective here.
Yeah, and I think medical documentation of not only the primary medical condition that you're treating, but also, some of the comorbidities, may be one route because, as you mentioned, there are some approvals for other indications for these medications. I think that, second, a doc-to-doc call is never a bad idea. If you have someone who is doing really, really well and you're concerned about what may be on the formulary for the insurance company and how they may have an adverse reaction to that for whatever reason, I think is a good thing to do. And then, lastly, really having that conversation with that individual to determine, which insurance they're going to pick in the next round. Because, we all have these open, seasons where we can make changes. And for some folks, they may need to get on another plan that has more options available to them so that ultimately long term they can meet their health related chronic conditions, head on because they have the right medication for them. So our last learning objective today is to develop patient-centered counseling strategies that address concerns or misperceptions about GLP-1 receptor agonist therapies, including evidence-based benefits. Here are some common barriers and gaps that set both providers and patients up for failure. Some of the provider gaps are inadequate counseling on expected symptoms and mitigation strategies, as we discussed earlier. Insufficient multidisciplinary communication among cardiology, endocrinology, nephrology. Some of the patient gaps are things like stopping drugs due to manageable side effects without contacting providers, unrealistic expectations for speed of weight loss or glycemic effect, or lack of dietary adjustments to reduce nausea or GI upset, even when counseled appropriately. So let's talk a bit about misperceptions versus medical realities. So some of the misperceptions are things like, I won't want to eat food anymore. The GI side effects last forever and are persistent. The compounded GLP-1 receptor agonists have the same safety and efficacy as FDA-approved GLP-1 receptor agonists. And that GLP-1 receptor agonists are cosmetic, expensive weight loss drugs that are not cost-effective. So what do we know? What are some of the medical realities around these important concepts? One, we know that GI-related side effects are dose-dependent, short-term, and we have strategies to mitigate them. We also know that people still want to eat. They still have an appetite, even after starting a GLP-1 agonist. And we will help them to ensure that they are still enjoying eating, particularly healthy eating.
For the first time on the GLP-1, and I know when celebrities say it cuts down the food noise, and I was like, yeah. It really does. It's a different kind of dance that you have to do with your family. So for my husband and I, instead of At first, I was like, I don't want to go to the ice cream store now, but now I'll go and figure out what I can have. There might be some sherbet, or I can get the mini and I can have that, so that we can still enjoy each other and still bond over some eating, but it's just different than it has been. And it takes some time to get used to it.
We know that when we look at the maintenance treatment really support weight and management of weight-related chronic conditions. And we also know that compounded GLP-1 receptor agonists are not FDA tested. They can be linked to adverse events or dosing errors, and they have unknown ingredients. Ultimately, we know that GLP-1 receptor agonists aren't cost-effective, especially for individuals with type 2 diabetes or cardiovascular kidney metabolic syndrome. And so when we think about this, Myra, thinking about these misperceptions and medical realities, what is the number one misperception that you hear?
In the area where I practice, we have predominantly Hispanic adults, patients. Some of the culture here is that if you lose too much weight, you are going to look sick. So you should not be on these agents because it's going to make you lose a lot of weight. And then you're going to, your family members start telling you that you're starting to look unhealthy, unwell. Despite that, the opposite is probably occurring. You're improving your sugars. Now you have your diabetes very well controlled. But now you're having your family members come up and approach you like, are you ill? What's going on? So that's one of the major misperceptions that I've seen and I've encountered in my clinical practice.
So the cultural perceptions of weight and what weight means, very, very important. Whereas the medical reality is that person may actually be getting healthier and not sicker. A great call out there. Let's move on to patient case SB. SB is a 45-year-old man who is returning for follow-up after starting a GLP-1 receptor agonist 8 weeks ago. He has lost 4.6 kilograms, a little over 9 pounds, and is experiencing moderate nausea following meals that seems to be increasing with use. He is reluctant to proceed beyond the starting dose because of his nausea and worries about losing muscle mass and developing what he has termed GLP-1 receptor agonist face. He has been on social media and has seen it there. Socially, he's recently engaged. His wedding is in 7 months. And medically, he has type 2 diabetes, hypertension, and MASH. So we're going to come back to this case a little bit later, but I want you to think about Mr. SB as we move forward. Some of the practical pearls, though, for success in patient communication are also critical to this, because when we are talking about the side effects and how to mitigate that, we have to communicate that in a way that all individuals can understand. So we want to be honest, empathetic. We want to provide evidence-based counseling to combat all the social noise. We have to provide ongoing education on the benefits, risk, and expectations of treatment. We want to provide clear written communications and instructions or reminders on managing common side effects, the planned dose escalation process, and when or how to contact our offices for support. We know that we also have patient communication systems such as the electronic health record. We have follow-up scheduling protocols, and we can also utilize telehealth. Lastly, shared decision-making throughout the process is critical. We want to identify patient values, preferences, and needs, and meet patients where they are in their journey, acknowledging the changes as they arise. So we talked about patient communication. Now we're going to talk about shared decision-making. They emphasize the importance of having a standard set of questions, conversation prompts, and patient education aids ready for each encounter. And I love infographics there because most people can understand infographics. Facilitate the sharing of information among all parties and ensure it's a conversation. The healthcare provider and patient or the caregiver, everyone must be involved. Number three, Become comfortable navigating differences of opinion with patients and caregivers. This is something that is really built into the bones and DNA of being a healthcare provider. Number four, build a consensus about the preferred plan of action. Make sure everybody's on the same team in terms of this plan. And number five, which is really, really critical, verify that agreement is reached before acting, right? Make sure everyone is on the same page before you kind of set the plan in action. When we think about GLP-1 receptor agonists, this is ensuring that everyone understands not only the benefits, but also those side effects, how we're going to mitigate those side effects. What is our dosing strategy? How are we going to escalate the dose, right? When to call, right? All these important elements, we have to develop a plan of action around and then verify that everyone is on the same page and that agreement is reached. Some of the other counseling points include rotating the injection site so that individuals do not develop nodules underneath the skin, as well as they ensure that the medication is getting where it needs to go within the body. Number two, utilizing the appropriate injection techniques, ensuring that that medication is actually getting into the body. You don't know how many times I've seen individuals who are injecting more into the air than they are into their body. This has been made better with some of our newer medications and the injection devices that they use. And number three, tissue scarring and absorption problems. And this really comes back to number one, ensuring that we are rotating the injection sites so that individuals do not develop scarring over time. Dr. Myra, what do you tell people about injecting and particularly around rotating the sites?
I think this is, a very vital educational component as providers that sometimes we can often overlook, but it really emphasizes the importance of, taking the time to educating them that injection site selection, the rotation, but also something that I've come is to have your patients show you, because you'd be surprised. Sometimes we ask the right questions and the patients are answering them correctly. You ask them, do you rotate your injection sites? They say yes, but it just so happens that they're injecting it in that same area, but they're rotating it. So they're not lying. They're being very honest. So now I've come to be like, all right, okay, but show me. And, unfortunately, 7 out of 10 times I have patients that they're like, well, I'm just injecting around the belly button. And I'm like, okay. So I tell them, I show them, I point to the areas where they can alternate to, that it's not just around the belly button where we have subcutaneous tissue. There's plenty of tissue that we can choose when it comes to using these GLP-1 therapies.
Great, great. That is really important. We actually have a diagram in our office that shows all the areas on the abdomen, the leg, the arms, everywhere where individuals can inject. That's a critically important point. Thank you for sharing that. Next, we're going to go back to our patient, SB. We've talked about SB. You know that he's on a GLP-1 receptor agonist for the last 8 weeks. You know he's experiencing some moderate nausea. You know that he has concerns around GLP-1 receptor agonist face. What I haven't told you yet is that his A1C is 7%, down from 7.6%. His BMI is 25, down from 27. And his estimated glomerular filtration rate is greater than 90. So the question is now, how are we going to respond to his concerns? And it seems like at this point, the two major concerns, if we can recap here, are the nausea concern, as well as the GLP-1 receptor agonist face. And so if we go back to our earlier discussions around nausea, there are tried and proven ways that we can help this gentleman. One is that we can talk about smaller meals. Two, we can talk about the character of those meals, what's in those meals. Three, we can talk about fiber and water, ensuring intake of a balanced diet that will lead to less nausea. The second part is really around the GLP-1 receptor agonist face. And What we know about that is due to decreases in subcutaneous fat around the face that occur. The important piece is that it occurs when you have rapid weight loss. It's not a GLP-1 receptor agonist effect. It is really a weight loss effect. And things that individuals can do to both prevent that as well as to, continue to have good muscle mass is to eat, appropriately, well-balanced meals, as well as to ensure that they are being physically active during their, particularly with resistance training and other things, while they are taking a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And then at the end of the day, thinking about how aggressive we want to be with dose escalation and weight loss, right? And so we may go a little slower on their dose escalation with the goal of losing maybe 1 or 2 pounds a week so that they lose weight slower and their body can adjust. And so there are things that we can do to address this concern of loss of subcutaneous fat around the face.
So one of the key things that I also emphasize and I tell my patients is you do want to make sure that you get the proper nutrition. You know, even though you can be like, well, I'm not hungry. I can go hours without eating. No, you still want to make sure that you still have, you know, your three meals, your snacks in between, but just healthier options and smaller portions.
Great comments. So next, we want to talk about the multidisciplinary team that it takes to ensure success with utilization of GLP-1 receptor agonists. And that team includes dietitians for nutrition counseling. It includes pharmacists when we think about prescribing these medications. It includes nurse practitioners like Myra. It includes physician associates. And other specialists like myself, an endocrinologist, can all be part of the multidisciplinary team. I think most of us think about all of those individuals as part of a multidisciplinary team among individuals who are treating individuals for weight loss or for diabetes with GLP-1 receptor agonists. One that we often don't think about, and I want to point out, is really mental health services. These medications change the way people look, which changes how they interact and engage with society. And it may be them who could benefit from some mental health services, both in the pre-period and during treatment. And it may be the individuals around them who see them now as a different person. All of these things really require mental health support. And then that is a team member I encourage you all to really think about with prescribing GLP-1 receptor agonists.
I think you totally need to have support. I actually have a therapist that I see, and she was able to tell me, the journey's not going to be, even with the GLP-1, it's not going to be straight. You lose 5 pounds a week and there you go. You're going to still hit some plateau things. You're going to still need to monitor what you eat. You're still going to, because you still are in control of what goes in your mouth. And you can out eat just like you can out eat a gastric sleeve, a gastric bypass, a lap band. You can out eat a GLP-1. So there's still a good bit of personal responsibility there.
Myra, anything you want to say about multidisciplinary teams and the importance that lay within?
I think one of the things too is, your diabetes care and education specialist, make sure that you have one on board. They're very, they are critical to this team as well, and they can provide those additional emphasis on education and follow-ups for our patients that they need. But I love that you mentioned mental health services because, just hearing you say that, it really took me back to a patient that I just, saw last week where I really wanted him to be on a GLP-1, giving his core morbidities. Like I saw the benefit of, what these agents were going to be able to do for him. And he said he had a very negative experience because this is what he said, and I can try to quote him. It really made him depressed. He loved food, and food is something that he would take pride on and he enjoyed. So when he was on this agent, he's like, it just made me sad. Like that was my comfort. That was my go-to of enjoying life. So if you're going to put me on this agent, and take away the fact that I can't enjoy food? Absolutely not. So this is one where I had to have that conversation with him, and I actually referred him to our one of our counselors, because I think they needed to provide that additional assessment of what else is going on. And I really did my best in trying to educate him and the reason for choosing this agent.
And you mentioned certified diabetes care and education specialists. They're really at the center of all this, right? They're on every team. We have to have them. They're really critical as we think about engaging with individuals with diabetes. So thank you for that, Myra. Lastly, on my side, we'll talk about SMART goals here. SMART goals are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely or time-bound. And so it really helps to put information into actions. You share information on misconceptions and medical realities at your next team meeting to encourage staff engagement, right? That's something that you can do. You can review and update your GLP-1 receptor agonist dosing protocols in the next 30 days to reflect agent-specific, evidence-based titration and escalation strategies. You notice how it says in the next 30 days or at the next team meeting. These are all how you make these things timely when you think about them. You can use shared decision making at every patient encounter to personalize GLP-1 receptor agonist therapy, ensuring patients understand the benefits, risks, and expectations for their treatment journey. And lastly, you can provide patients with clear written instructions on how to manage common side effects, the planned dose escalation process, and when to contact your office for support. I would like to thank Myra for the discussion today. It's really, really been incredible. Thank you so much.
No, thank you, Dr. Joseph. It's been a real pleasure to be able to share our perspectives and learn from you as well.
I share the same sentiment. I've learned a ton from you as well, Dr. Condazzaro, today. I would also like to thank CME Outfitters for producing this program. You can find more information for you and your patients by visiting the Metabolic Diseases Hub. Please watch the other programs in this series and don't forget to register for our live Q&A on November 13, 2025 at 6:30 p.m. with Dr. Amy Rothberg and Dr. Jay Shubrick. When you register, you can submit questions for them to answer. If you watch the whole series, not only can you get continuing education credit, but you can claim a badge as a patient-first diabetes management champion. Who doesn't want to be a champion? Don't forget to take the post-test and evaluation to claim your CME or CE credit. We want to thank CME Outfitters for helping make this program possible, and we thank you so much for participating.